This episode of the Bulaq podcast is produced in collaboration with the Sheikh Zayed Book Award. The Sheikh Zayed Book Award is one of the Arab world's most prestigious literary prizes, showcasing the stimulating and ambitious work of writers, translators, researchers, academics, and publishers advancing Arab literature and culture around the globe. Today's guest, Andrew Peacock, is the 2025 Sheikh Zayed Book Award winner in the category of Arab culture in other languages. He is professor of Islamic history at the University of St. Andrews. His scholarship focuses on the pre-modern history of the Islamic world, its intellectual culture, and its manuscripts. His book, Arabic Literary Culture in Southeast Asia in the 17th and 18th Century, looks at the spread and use of Arabic, its relation to impassioned debates about religious ideas, and to the practice of politics and power. The Sheikh Zayed Book Award Translation Grant is open all year round, with funding available for fiction titles that have won or been shortlisted for the award. Publishers outside the Arab world are eligible to apply. Find out more on the Sheikh Zayed Book Award website at zayedaward.ae.
Welcome to Bulaq, episode 116. I'm Marsha Links Quayle in Rabat, and I'm joined, as always, by Ursula Lindsay, who is now in Brussels. Our guest today is Andrew Peacock, who's at St. Andrews, and who's here to talk about his award-winning book on Arabic literary culture in Southeast Asia. Welcome, Andrew, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join you.
By way of introduction, Andrew Peacock is Bishop Wardlaw Professor of Islamic History at the University of St. Andrews and the author of 5 monographs and 15 edited volumes covering the history of the Eastern Islamic world and the Indian Ocean from medieval to early modern times. Recent publications include, as editor, Iran and the Persianate Culture in the Indian Ocean World, Bloomsbury 2024, and co-editor with Annabel Teh-Gallup from Anatolia to Aceh, Ottomans, Turks, and Southeast Asia, which came out in 2015. And then, of course, there's the book we're talking about today, his 2024 Arabic Literary Culture in Southeast Asia in the 17th and 18th Centuries, which won a 2025 Sheikh Zayed Book Award. So sort of first to start us off, as you suggest in the book, many people see Arabic as a language that in Southeast Asia is solely for religious ritual, one that maybe has been employed, spoken, but not understood, and much less used in a creative way. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the use and appeal in Arabic in Southeast Asia starting in the 17th century.
Sure. Well, as you say, yeah, there is this very widespread idea that Arabic was just a sacred language, which really didn't have any local literary production at all, and wasn't really understood, you know, except for by a few members of the ulema. Now, I think it is definitely true that, Arabic had a limited circulation, but it is clear that it was much more extensively used than has been appreciated. And in particular, it had a high status at royal courts. There seems to be a certain association between Arabic and power, and this made it an attractive language for local sultanates to employ, both for compositions which were related to religion and politics and the ways in which they were intertwined, but also for more practical purposes as a language of diplomacy. So Arabic existed alongside a host of other languages in Southeast Asia, obviously. There was the sort of regional lingua franca, which was Malay, and then in each area there would usually be other languages as well, such as Javanese in Java, and other varieties of Malay in Sumatra and on other islands, completely different languages. And of course, Portuguese and then later Dutch also play a role as intermediary languages, as languages of trade. And even Persian does too. So it's a very complex linguistic situation in which Arabic is one element. But I think because of its particular importance to these royal courts, it has a certain importance historically, which hasn't really been appreciated to date.
And you write in the introduction to your book, it partly originated from a visit to the National Library in Jakarta in 2010, and is also linked to the survival of a particular library of the Sultanate of Bantan. Can you tell us a bit more about the origins of the book and of the research, and maybe of what your assumptions or expectations were at the beginning and how those changed?
Sure. So I went to Jakarta in connection with a completely different project in 2010 and was taken to the National Library. I thought it might be interesting to see what holdings they had. I mean, it turned out that the only catalogue of the Arabic material was this Latin volume produced in the 1850s under Dutch rule. And I had assumed, because this is what one reads in the secondary literature, that, Arabic was, as we were saying before, this language which wasn't widely used. So, you know, I expected to encounter a few well-known fiqh texts, for example, and other sort of Islamic classics. But I was surprised when opening this rather dusty catalogue, which I don't think had been consulted for many years or possibly many decades, to find that there were a host of authors that I had never heard of before and titles that I had never heard of before. Some of which were clearly, even from a very brief inspection, local authors about whom, you know, pretty much no information seemed to exist. So I determined to return and pursue the subject at a subsequent date, thinking it might make an interesting short article. But as I investigated, it turned out that, in fact, this Latin catalogue was effectively the catalogue of the library of the Sultanate that had joined Jakarta, the Sultanate of Banten, about 50 kilometres away. And the Sultanate had been abolished at the beginning of the 19th century by the Dutch, and its library, along with all the other royal paraphernalia, confiscated and brought to museums in Batavia and learned institutions in Batavia, as Jakarta was then called. So it transpired we hadn't just got a random collection of Arabic manuscripts, but rather we had the remains of the library of a sultanate. And the curious thing was that almost everything that we can identify as coming from the Sultan's library was in Arabic. There's almost nothing that was in Malay, and there was almost nothing that was in Javanese, which was the main local literary language and was the main language of administration of this sultanate. And on this occasion, we know that we're not actually missing something, because we have a catalogue that was produced, a handwritten catalogue that was produced by the Dutch officials who were responsible for recording what had been confiscated. So this is useful to compare with the existing manuscripts. We can see that, you know, there are a number of items which have gone missing, but it gives us gives us sort of a reassurance that, in fact, this library was almost entirely in Arabic when it was captured. And this is, you know, extremely surprising, because no one's really thought of the idea of whole libraries, particularly not royal libraries, consisting entirely of Arabic texts in this region before. So it became clear that, you know, this needed further investigation, and that whilst the library had been confiscated at the beginning of the 19th century, many of the texts and manuscripts it contained were much older, dating back to the 17th century. Now, the 17th century is really important in the history of Southeast Asia, because this is the period where Islam really begins to spread on a wide scale throughout the archipelago. So we have an enormous sort of process of Islamization, of conversion to Islam, and the spread of Islamic culture more generally, witnessed by, you know, the building of mosques, the adoption of titles like Sultan and so on. So what we've been lacking, though, is, you know, much textual evidence to date of these processes in terms of manuscripts, because not that many manuscripts survive from before the 19th century in Southeast Asia. So it was also clear that this was, of considerable significance from that point of view, because it was actually considerably older than most surviving collections or manuscripts in the region, which date to post 1800 on the whole.
And sorry, I'm just going to do one follow-up on this. And so the surprise was not only to find this existing library in Arabic, and then its contents were works that were produced in Arabic by local scholars.
Its contents were mixed. So on the one hand, you did have works which were produced by local scholars, some of which don't exist in any other copies anywhere else. So, you know, it's extremely important for that point of view of preserving these works, which we don't otherwise have any copies of, and most of which have never been published to date. But it doesn't just contain Southeast Asian manuscripts. It also contains manuscripts from the Middle East that were brought to Southeast Asia by pilgrims and so on. And actually, it became clear that many of the annotations on these could help us trace their origins and their travels and how they came, the networks which brought them to Southeast Asia. So they give us an insight into the intellectual history of earlier periods and sort of the networks that linked the Muslim world, which in fact we can see from these texts actually stretch all the way from Morocco to Java.
Yeah, it was really that, you know, this really caught my attention, of course, that one of these manuscripts shows up in Rabat. I wondered if you could talk more about these pathways. You refer to kind of four regions or four major cities or regions where Arabic is used more prominently. And I wondered if you could talk about some of these pathways of movement, who is going where in order to study Arabic, and how are these texts and people moving around?
Sure. So obviously the great sort of meeting place of the Islamic world in this period, as all periods, is the Hejaz, but not just because of its role, as a centre of pilgrimage, but it's also a very substantial in the 17th century and 18th century. The Hejaz and Medina in particular are very important centres of scholarship. And people from throughout the Islamic world travel there to study at the feet of the great scholars, of whom one of the most famous is a Kurdish scholar called Ibrahim al-Qurani, who attracts students from, you know, all the extremes of the Islamic world. We have students from Takrur in West Africa, from the Maghreb, and of course from Indonesia. So the Hejaz was, if you like, the meeting point of all these people, and it was where the intellectuals of the 17th century Islamic world exchanged texts, manuscripts, and of course, ideas with each other in these study circles with these Medinan ulama. So we have manuscripts in Jakarta, which are produced in the Hejaz, which in fact have annotations by Al-Qurani, this great Kurdish scholar of Medina, and which, you know, have information about his study circle, because texts in them are copied by a variety of individuals, both from Indonesia and from Egypt and the Maghreb as well. So the manuscripts provide valuable evidence for these processes of diffusion. When we come to Southeast Asia, it's clear that Arabic learning wasn't sort of evenly distributed across the archipelago. And rather there were sort of four main centers where Arabic was particularly propagated. So one is in the north of Sumatra, the region of Aceh. And in many ways, this isn't particularly surprising, because Aceh has always been considered to be the region of Southeast Asia, which has the closest links with the Middle East. In Indonesian, it's often referred to as the Serambi Mecca, the veranda of Mecca.
Love that.
So, you know, if there's anywhere one would expect there to be Arabic influences, it would be in Aceh. And for some of the 18th century, Aceh was actually ruled by a dynasty which originated in Hadramaut in Yemen. Not many libraries from Aceh have been preserved. So to date, most of our knowledge of its literary culture has been based on Malay sources, Malay being, the sort of main courtly language. So the Jakarta collection preserves texts which were copied in Aceh, which otherwise we don't know anything about. The other main center, which we were talking about earlier, was Banten in Java, just outside Jakarta, which emerges as an important sultanate at the beginning of the 17th century. It sort of plays a crucial role in as an intermediary in the spice trade, and it also produces large amounts of pepper, so it's frequently visited by Europeans, as well as, of course, by Middle Eastern merchants. And this really sort of forms the foundation of the wealth of the Sultanate. And it's clear that the sultans in the 17th and 18th centuries propagate Arabic learning. As we were mentioning before, and that's where this amazing library comes from. So again, this is a region with, you know, close and well-documented links with the Middle East. The Javanese chronicles tell us about how the ruler of Banten in the 17th century sent away to the Hejaz to ask the Sharif of Mecca to bestow the title of Sultan upon him, becoming the first ruler in the region to be called Sultan. So the existence of a connection with the Middle East and the Sultanate is, again, well documented, but now we're able to, you know, give it some more basis in the Arabic sources as well. Mm. The third and fourth areas, however, where Arabic was propagated in Southeast Asia are a bit more surprising, perhaps, at first glance. They're two different areas on or near the same island of Sulawesi in eastern Indonesia, a large island with very diverse cultures on it, which converted, the southern parts of which converted very rapidly to Islam in the 17th century. And it was dominated by two powers, the Sultanate of Makassar on the west coast and Bone on the East Coast. But there were also a number of other Muslim sultanates in the south of the island, as well as various non-Muslim kingdoms in the north. Now, we know that the Sultanate of Bonaire also was very interested in Arabic, but our main evidence for this basically hangs on one surviving manuscript. So, as I've mentioned before, there are severe problems with the preservation of manuscripts in Southeast Asia, which means we don't have very much surviving from before the about 1800. So, it's really by chance that one manuscript made its way somehow into the collections of the Sultanate, into the collections of the Sultanate of Banten, it seems, and then into the National Library in Jakarta, ultimately, which was the personal manuscript of a late 18th century sultan, which contains a collection of texts in Arabic, some of which were composed specifically for him, others of which were composed by local rulers. So this one manuscript gives us a sort of insight that we wouldn't otherwise have into the existence of an Arabic language culture in this region of eastern Sulawesi. The other area of Sulawesi where it's clear that Arabic was widespread, at least in courtly circles, is an island called Bouton, just off the southeast of the main island of Sulawesi. And this had quite a rich indigenous literary culture in Arabic, as well as in Malay and the local courtly language, which is called Wolio. However, none of these manuscripts are preserved anywhere other than on the island itself, and all of them remain in private hands today. Fortunately, a few have been digitized, but it's really only by going there in person and, you know, having local contacts that you can get any impression of the extent of this literary culture. So, you know, this also sort of hints at the possibility that we might only be scraping the surface. There are lots of manuscripts which are only preserved in private collections in Southeast Asia, you know, so I mean, it's entirely possible there may be new things to come to light in the future. We may discover new regions where Arabic was used, because as I say, in some instances like Bonaire, our evidence just hangs on a single manuscript. You know, so we can't exclude the possibility that in the future we'll get an impression that Arabic was more widely diffused, but for the moment it seems that these were the four main centers in the region.
And I just want to quickly reassure people that I'm going to take a photograph of the map in Andrew's book to share it, so that people can get a visual sense of where these places are as well.
Yeah, and maybe a few images of the beautiful pages of these manuscripts, which are just sort of lovely to look at, and which there are many reproductions of in the book. So you lay all this out in your book, like this linguistic landscape in which, as you say, Arabic is one of many languages being used. The fact that it seems to be being used because of its you know, either for diplomacy, for commerce, because of its relationship to power, and then of course because of its relationship to religion, because of its holiness, and that you have these scholars going to the Hejaz, learning Arabic, bringing back manuscripts, but then also using Arabic in their own writing, and that one of the topics that they are the most interested in writing about is Sufism and some of the metaphysical and theological debates within Sufism.
Yeah, well, in this period, particularly in the 17th and 18th century, Sufism was in many ways sort of the nexus of intellectual debates in the Islamic world. You know, there were huge controversies in the period as to the validity of certain Sufi ideas, particularly connected with the with the concept of Wahdat al-Wujud and unity of being. How you could interpret this idea, which is, you know, sort of associated with the school of Ibn Arabi and so on, without falling into the dangers of pantheism. So controversies about, you know, this idea of the unity of being were not just academic. You know, they led to people calling each other heretics. According to some accounts, they led to books being burnt in Aceh. And, you know, there were controversies which spread throughout the Islamic world. You know, we can see in Istanbul in the period, for example, there are debates, again, similarly, between you know, proponents of Wahdat al-Wujud and those who think that it's a dangerous idea, or that it's a dangerous idea if not interpreted properly. And part of the reasons for these controversies is also because there's a certain sort of association between politics and Sufism as well, and in particular, this idea of unity of being. And again, this is a sort of pan-Islamic phenomenon. So in the Ottoman Empire, it's well known that Ibn Arabi was effectively adopted as the patron saint of the dynasty. And there seems at times to have been sort of official sponsorship for this these ideas of Wahdat al-Wujud. And similarly in Southeast Asia, there also seems to be a close association between politics and these ideas. And these ideas could be profoundly disturbing or useful from a religious point of view, but at the same time they also had a political uses, and in particular the idea of unity of being contains within it the concept of the perfect man, someone who can basically embody all the virtues of Muhammad in his person by passing through the various stages of the Sufi path, and thereby encompassing in himself complete knowledge of both the world and creation. And it's not hard to see how, for some rulers, such ideas might have been attractive as well.
It gives the ruler or even the scholar who achieves this human perfection an enormous amount of legitimacy and authority.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
to make claim to have this,
both legitimacy, but it also provides a foundation for their authority. And if we think particularly in Southeast Asia, in this period, you've had this very rapid conversion to Islam. So basically, the old order, the old means by which, you know, rulers legitimize themselves, and the old means by which people think about power no longer exists. You know, it does provide a means by which this exercise of sultanic power can now be explained. And, you know, some people have argued that it had, that, you know, these ideas of unity and being and the position of the sultan as someone who has perfect knowledge, if he becomes the perfect man, has resemblances to pre-Islamic ideas that would have been current in Southeast Asia, particularly derived from Buddhist ideals of rulership. So in that sense, it could be argued such ideas provide continuity over time as well. You know, they allow in this period of rapid change and upheaval, they provide a means for older ideas to be rephrased and re-expressed in an Islamic context.
So speaking of that, there were a couple of figures in the book that really stood out to me. And one of them is Hamza Fansouri, both for his poetry and, you know, and which included, you know, a sort of a popular element of his poetry, and for how his ideas kind of continued to resonate and people continued to push back against them for years to come. And I wanted to just quickly read this snippet of a translated poem of his that begins, that in your book, that begins, "Listen, O perfect man, do not pursue vain knowledge. Nothing is to be gained from the words of ignorant people." Mansur's words, "I am the supreme reality," were spoken in union. Hamza Fansouri is completely submerged in the unfathomable ocean. When the gale dies down and the waves subside, he will be the sovereign of both worlds. And I wondered if you could tell us a bit about Hamza Fansouri, his poems in Malay, and how they incorporated Arabic, and just, you know, how he continued to be an important figure.
Hamza Fansouri is one of the greatest figures in the history of Malay literature. He writes both these amazing poems which propagate these ideas of unity of being, and in addition to some prose works. Unfortunately, when we come down to pinning down the historical person, we're confronted with an almost complete lack of sources, and scholars don't even agree completely as to when he lived. It seems most likely that he lived at the beginning of the 17th century and the late 16th century, but there are a few people who would date him a whole 100 years earlier. So we don't have very many good biographical sources for him. And most of the information about him comes, you know, that's remotely trustworthy, comes from his own poems and those of his disciples. He had a number of followers who wrote poems in a similar style. So it seems from these that he originally came from West Sumatra, from the port of Barus, which traditionally was a region with quite close links to the Middle East, as it specialized in the production and export of camphor. And there's, you know, there is some evidence from local archaeological work that's been done there of its connections with the region, even a funerary inscription in Persian, for example, has been discovered there. At any rate, it seems that somewhere Hamza acquired a good knowledge of both Persian and Arabic. His works are full of allusions to classical Persian poetry, and they're full of Arabic words, which to a much, much greater extent than any other Malay poet of the period. At the same time, they're extremely melodic. So one must, and, you know, we have accounts of, you know, people, huge numbers of people gathering to hear them. They're clearly sort of recited popularly. So despite the fact their vocabulary must have made them quite inaccessible in some ways, they clearly exerted a power over the listener as well. So in terms of the rest of Hamza's biography, insofar as we can reconstruct it on the basis of his poems and those of his followers, it seems likely that he spent some time in the city of Shahrinau, which is now Ayutthaya in Thailand, where there would have been a substantial Persian community as a major commercial center, and also in the Middle East. And one of these poems does mention his visits to Baghdad and to the Hijaz, and seems to allude to him acquiring Sufi knowledge there. Of course, the problem is with poems is that you never know how literally you should take this. I mean, it's also conceivable this is meant in a metaphorical way, that it doesn't describe a literal journey to the Hijaz. It describes a spiritual journey to the Hijaz, for example. So it's unlikely that we'll ever be able to put much flesh on him as a person beyond these bare bones. But it is clear from his works that he was well read both in Sufi literature in Arabic and Persian, and so it seems quite credible that he also would have spent some time in the Middle East as well. His poems, however, were also extremely controversial because of the propagation of these ideas of Wahdat al-Wujud, which I was talking about earlier. So whilst we have evidence that they spread very widely across the whole archipelago, only a few years after his death, we have evidence of them circulating both in Java and in Sulawesi, so places which are really quite a long way away from North Sumatra, which is where he was originally from and where he was active, insofar as we can infer from the texts we have. At the same time, there was a great reaction against him in Malay texts, which were composed to condemn his ideas and to try and argue that basically these were dangerous heresies that should not be circulated. So he remains an intensely controversial. He remained an intensely controversial figure in the period, and to a degree, I think you could even say he remains somewhat controversial today. I mean, there is no modern edition in Southeast Asia of his poems. So,
really,
despite his status as one of the great poets of Malay, actually acquiring a copy of his works in either Malaysia or Indonesia is almost impossible.
Huh? How interesting.
So they exist in sort of.
There were two European editions done by Dutch scholars in the 20th century. But
how do people locally access them then? Are they online?
Some of them are available online. But I think he's more a name with which people are familiar than someone whose works are particularly widely read. Maybe a couple of the less controversial examples of his work may be taught in schools or whatever. But on the whole, as I say, he is the topics of Sufism and its uses remain controversial in Southeast Asia today, which is, I think, why his works aren't widely circulated there today. It's not the kind of thing, obviously, it's the kind of thing that if you're a scholar, you could find in a scholarly library in the European edition. It's not the kind of thing you could go into a bookshop and expect to find.
Huh. And there is another figure that we wanted to talk about that we were both struck with as a different, equally interesting profile and life story. And this is Yusuf al-Makasri, who lived between 1627 and 1699 approximately. And maybe before we get into discussing him, or as an introduction to discussing him, Marcia, would you mind reading the short biography that's written of him by a fellow scholar and that's quoted in the book? It just gives such a great sense of his path up to a certain point, because it doesn't even get to the end of his life.
Right, which is exciting. We won't give it away.
Right.
Sheikh Yusuf Etej bin Afif al-Din bin Abi al-Khair al-Jawi al-Maqasiri, the virtuous Sheikh, the Sufi, he who possesses Tawheed, the learned and diligent, the swimmer in the currents of the seas of Tawheed, from which he extracted the unique essence by his fine diving. He was born in his country around 1630 and undertook the Hajj, joining the circle of Ibn Alain. Then he went back to Yemen and joined the circle of our Sheikh Ahmed al-Ajl al-Zabd and Abdurrahim al-Khas, and was inducted into the Tariqah by Sheikh Abdul Baqi al-Mijjaji. He then went back to Haramain a second time, performing the pilgrimage and visiting sacred sites and meeting with our Sheikh Safi al-Din al-Qushashi al-Ahmadi in Medina. He studied with him, then traveled to Damascus, where he joined the circle of Sheikh Muhammad Amin and the Sheikh of Damascus, whose intimate he became. He was inducted into the Tariqah by him, and he devoted himself to his service, studying with him, gaining benefit, and joining his Tariqah. He was inducted by him and put on the khirqa, and was given permission to teach the books he had studied. Then he went back to the Haramain and studied with our Sheikh Mullah Ibrahim al-Qurani, joining his circle. We learned from each other. Then he traveled to Yemen, where he studied with various masters, including our Sheikh Abdurrahim al-Khas. The latter informed me that a disaster befell passengers of a ship he was in, and he fell asleep, dreaming that he was suckling in my lap. Then he woke up and gave us tidings that we were out of danger, and so it passed, by God's will. Sheikh Yusuf returned to his country and started corresponding with me. Many people benefited from him, and I heard that he attained a great rank with the Sultan, such that the latter and his children studied with him and benefited from him in prayer. Thus did his wives, wealth, and progeny multiply.
Then, of course, there's more to his story, because he takes sides in a political struggle and ends up in exile. But Andrew, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about Al-Makasiri, who also is one of the figures who wrote the most in Arabic, as I understand.
Yes, that's right. He wrote an enormous number of works in Arabic. So he's one of the rather few scholars from Southeast Asia who appears in the Arabic sources, which is why this passage you just read out is so intriguing. You know, we know of lots of other Southeast Asian scholars who go to the Hejaz, but generally speaking, the Arabic, you know, they're too obscure for the Arabic sources to notice, however famous they may have later become in Southeast Asia. So Al-Makasiri seems to be one of the rather few who is both makes enough of a mark to be recorded in the Arabic sources, but also has this immense status in Southeast Asia, which, again, he's someone who is extremely famous today, even if his works are almost entirely unread, because they're almost entirely unpublished. But after he returns from the Middle East, he's employed at the Sultanate of Banten near Jakarta, where this great library comes from, and he seems to have been employed as the spiritual guide and tutor to the heir to the throne. Now, this Sheikh Yusuf's arrival in Banten coincides with the expansion of Dutch power in Java. And the Dutch increasingly interfere in the politics of the Sultanate, not at this stage with the idea of abolishing it, but rather with the idea of installing a friendly ruler on the throne. So in the late 17th century, as a result of these Dutch interventions, a civil war breaks out between a pro-Dutch camp and an anti-Dutch camp within the Sultanate, and Sheikh Yusuf is credited with leading the resistance. And, you know, there is some evidence, you know, he is sufficiently important that he also appears in Dutch archival records of the period. So his role in this anti-Dutch resistance is why he is remembered in Indonesia today as a national, as one of the national heroes of Indonesia. But his side also loses, and he is captured by the Dutch and is exiled, first of all, to Ceylon, modern Sri Lanka, where he continues to compose works in Arabic, and he continues to compose ones which are dedicated to the ruler of Banten. So it seems that from Ceylon, he's still able to maintain contact with Java, and many of the works composed in this period are short treatises, which are entirely Sufi in content, but which are destined for an audience back in Java. Subsequently, the Dutch decide possibly that Ceylon is too close to comfort, so they move him to South Africa, where he dies in 1699. But he's also remembered as an important figure in South African Islam, as that's where his burial place is, although there are also stories that the ruler of his home country of Sulawesi, Makassar in Sulawesi, asked for his body to be sent back after his death. So he has, in fact, two mausoleums, one in South Africa and one in Sulawesi. So, yes, he's this figure who sort of, in many ways, embodies the connections and the complexities of the period. You know, he spends a lot of time in the Middle East and not just in the Hejaz, but he certainly travels to Damascus and studies there with a local Damascus scholar, Ayub al-Khalwati. According to the sources, you know, the local histories and hagiographies written about him in Southeast Asia, he continued his travels as far as Istanbul. There's no evidence of that I've found of that in terms of the contemporary sources, but you know, we do have manuscripts copied by him from the Hejaz, and manuscripts copied by him which were probably made in Damascus as well. So we can document his travels, and we can document the people he studied with remarkable clarity. As you mentioned, he does produce this enormous number of works, many of them quite short, but which remain almost entirely unpublished to date.
Mm. And what do we know? It was the last 3 years of his life when he was in Cape Town.
Yeah.
What do we know about those final years of his life?
As far as we know, we don't have any writings which have been preserved from this period. Now, whether that's just because they haven't been preserved, or because, you know, he must have been by this stage relatively elderly, and it's possible that he stopped writing. So most our documentation for the last period of his life comes almost entirely from the Dutch sources, and you know, the Dutch regarded him as a political prisoner of some importance. So he was kept in relatively comfortable situation. But the Dutch were very wary of the danger of him making other Muslims getting it from Southeast Asia or the rest of the Muslim world trying to make contact with him. There was also a small Malay community in South Africa in this period, so he wouldn't have been totally isolated, but they wanted to get him as far away from causing any problems on Java as they could.
So I'm sorry, just one more question before we wrap up. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the rupture that happens in 1800 and why this important period of the 17th and 18th centuries of Arabic literary production in Southeast Asia sort of shifts at that point. What changes?
Yeah, so the big change is in the political setup. So, I mean, this Arabic literary production is very closely associated with the court, as I said earlier. Almost all of the texts are either dedicated to rulers or produced by figures that we know to have been active at royal courts. From the beginning of the 19th century, though, the role of European colonialism becomes increasingly pronounced in Southeast Asia. Local sultanates are increasingly either abolished or entirely deprived of their powers, which includes the resources that they needed to be able to sort of patronize literature on a wide scale. So the Sultanate of Banten is itself abolished, which, you know, is one of the major centers of Arabic literary culture. Similarly, the Sultanate of Bonae in Sulawesi is suffers severe defeats, and its library is pillaged by colonial forces. And so we have during the 18th century, during the 19th century, a great weakening of the traditional sources of patronage of Arabic literary culture in Southeast Asia. And I think that's one thing that that's one reason for this change. Now, this doesn't mean that Arabic completely disappears, because we have other things going on. So, for example, one of the phenomena of this period is of the late 18th century and early 19th century in particular, is a great increase in migration from Hadramaut to Southeast Asia. You know, there's some evidence of it happening in earlier times. You know, there are antecedents dating back at least to the 17th century, but it's from the second half of the 18th century onwards that this really picks up. So there are quite a number of migrants from Yemen in Southeast Asia, many of whom ultimately adopt Malay as their local language. But there's also some evidence for the production and circulation of Arabic texts amongst them in Southeast Asia. But, you know, these tend to be learned individuals, sheikhs, Sufis, and so on, rather than the traditional centers of the traditional patrons, the royal courts. Arabic becomes more associated with, you know, sort of the religious traditions of these Hadramis rather than the royal court. And there are a few places like that hold out for various reasons. This island of Bouton that I mentioned earlier off southeast Sulawesi. So that sort of manages to avoid direct colonial intervention. And in fact, you know, its great age of literary production in Arabic is the early 19th century, when the sultans themselves are producing works in Arabic there. So Arabic doesn't disappear, but the patterns of its patronage, the patterns of readership as well, change considerably. So that's a topic I'll hope to deal with on a future occasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for talking through a few of these things from your book. And I hope people also are inspired to get the book or check it out from their local library.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Pleasure talking to you and discovering a little bit about this landscape of Arabic writing that I knew nothing about. So thanks again for talking to us about this. And we'll be linking to the book and perhaps a few images from it in the show notes.
That'll be great. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be on the air again soon. Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to Bulaq wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulaq Books and Instagram at Bulaq.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulaq is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOWT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit ArabLit.org, where you can also subscribe to the ArabLit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulaq or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulaq@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.